Well, good morning, everybody. I want to welcome you to this day of thinking and talking about what it means to be Christian in our time and to be Christian and American in our time. And I encourage you to take seriously the fact that you have chosen to spend much of a Saturday thinking and talking about this. It says something very good about you. It says that you are taking your understanding of the Christian life seriously enough to invest this kind of time in it. And I encourage you to own that. I don't think you have to worry about becoming puffed up if you do. Psychologists tell us that the number one mental health issue in the United States today is low self-esteem, which reminds me of a story that Houston Smith, whose name many of you would recognize, told me once upon a time. It was about a letter that he had gotten from a high school senior. And the letter began as follows. Dear Professor Smith, I suffer from a low self of esteem. And on a Saturday morning, you might even feel that yourself, hard to know. And I want to start the day off with something a bit light. I want to share with you a number of church bloopers. Announcements that have appeared in church bulletins or in some cases were made orally, verbally during the announcement time of the service. The risk in doing this is that this is on the internet, so it's possible you may have run into it before. But all of these are actual bloopers. Okay? The fasting and prayer conference includes meals. The sermon this morning, Jesus walks on the water. This evening's sermon, searching for Jesus. Ladies, don't forget the rummage sale. It's a chance to get rid of those things not worth keeping around the house. Bring your husbands. Don't let worry kill you off. Let the church help. Miss Charlene Mason sang, I will not pass this way again, giving obvious pleasure to the congregation. Irving Benson and Jesse Carter were married on October 24th in the church. So ends a friendship that began in their school days. At the evening service tonight, the sermon topic will be, What is Hell? Come early and listen to our choir practice. A few more. The church will host an evening of fine dining, super entertainment, and gracious hostility. The ladies of the church have cast off clothing of every kind. You can see this one coming. Yeah. They may be seen in the basement on Friday afternoon. Low self-esteem support group will meet Thursday at 7 p.m. Please use the back door. Weight Watchers will meet at 7 p.m. at the First Presbyterian Church. Please use large double door at the side. And finally, the eighth graders will be presenting Shakespeare's Hamlet in the church basement Friday at 7. The congregation is invited to attend this tragedy. John has already said something about the format for this morning. I think my talk will be over with by 10:30, so we'll have from 10:30 until 11 for Q&A, and then book signing from 11 until 11:30, 11:40, something like that. And there'll be another opportunity for book signing this afternoon. And so I begin our day together with a prayer from the Celtic Christian tradition, that form of Christianity that flourished in Ireland and parts of Scotland, Wales, and Northern England beginning in the 4th, 5th century, and at least in Ireland remained the dominant form of Christianity until around the year 1000. And this is a morning prayer from around the year 700 from Celtic Christian Ireland. Christ as a light, illumine and guide me. Christ as a shield, overshadow me. Christ under me, Christ over me, Christ beside me, on my left and my right. This day be within and without me, lowly and meek, yet all-powerful. Be in the heart of each to whom I speak, in the mouth of each who speaks unto me. This day be within and without me, lowly and meek, yet all-powerful. Christ as a light, Christ as a shield, Christ beside me, on my left and my right. In your name, O Christ, our body and our blood, our life and our nourishment. Amen. So I turn to my first talk of the day. And as you know from the handout and the advanced publicity, the title of this talk is, Where Do We Meet the Sacred? And I begin with some comments about the title. By the way, I assume you have handouts, is that right? Yeah, okay, good. So I begin with some comments about the title. For many people, including many Christians, the notion that the sacred, for which the most common Western word is God, the notion that the sacred can be met sounds strange. Meeting God implies knowing or experiencing or encountering or at least glimpsing God the sacred. Yet for many people in the modern Western world, the word God refers to a being whose reality one can affirm only by believing. And some people believe, some are uncertain, some actively disbelieve, and Christians within this framework and people in other religions are oftentimes called believers. Indeed, in England, believer and Christian are virtual synonyms. In England, it's common to be asked, are you a believer? And that usually means, are you a Christian? Now, this understanding presupposes a common way of understanding the referent of the Word God. What we have in mind when we hear the Word or say the Word, what we are referring to. Namely, it is commonly understood that the word God refers to a supernatural being separate from the universe who created everything a long time ago as something separate from God. So on the one hand, there is God, and on the other hand, there is the universe, and they are separate and distinct from each other. If God is thought still to be active, it is through interventions, which is the only way a being separate from the universe can interact with it. Now, this way of understanding the referent of the word God has a shorthand designation. It is most commonly called the God of supernatural theism. God conceived of, thought of, as a separate being, and thus somewhere else. Now, for most believers in supernatural theism, God is also thought of as the supreme authority figure who has told us how to live and who will hold us responsible for how we have lived. And thus, another name for this way of thinking of the referent of the word God would be parental theism or parent theism. I turn now to the alternative, which begins with experiencing or meeting God. And I speak for a few minutes about the testimony of the tradition. And indeed, if I were redoing the handout, I would turn that into a plural, the testimony of the traditions, because this testimony comes not only from Christianity, but from basically all of the religions of the world. And the most vivid testimony comes from mysticism and from mystical experiences. A simple definition from medieval Christianity of what mysticism is, and I'm going to do it in Latin, partly to show the antiquity of the notion and partly to make you feel like you're getting your money's worth. Mysticism is the cognitio experimentalis Dei. And you can kind of see the English meaning of the phrase in the Latin meaning. Cognitio, cognition, knowledge. Experimentalis, experiential, and of course, Dei means God. Hence, mysticism is the experiential knowledge of God. God, the sacred, as experienced. And here, let me do a little aside that is not on the handout, as a way of saying a little bit more about mystical experiences. Scholars of mysticism commonly speak of two major categories of mystical experiences. The semi-technical words are introvertive and extrovertive, and the meaning of those words can be clarified by speaking of the first, extrovertive mystical experiences, as eyes-open mystical experiences. In these experiences, you see exactly what you would be seeing in any case. The same room full of people, the same landscape, whatever. You don't see any extra beings, no gods or goddesses or saints or Virgin Marys or whatever. But you see what you would otherwise be seeing, but it looks different. Commonly, it looks as if light is shining through everything, not in such a way that everything becomes transparent or even translucent, but as if everything is glowing, filled with light. Oftentimes the light changes and becomes lemony or golden. Everything becomes radiant, luminous. And this is what the Bible means when it speaks of the whole earth being filled with the glory of God. Glory in the Bible most commonly means radiance or luminosity. To see a landscape, a room full of people filled with the radiance of the sacred. These experiences, by the way, are typically very brief. A few seconds, sometimes a few minutes, rarely an hour or so. And some people never have them. Maybe 10% of our population have frequent such experiences. The other kind, introvertive mystical experiences, are eyes closed experiences. Oftentimes the eyes are literally closed. And these may involve visions. A vision of God or the goddesses, if it's a tradition other than Christianity, or a vision of Mary or of Jesus. Or sometimes they aren't visionary, but these experiences happen during states of contemplative prayer or meditation, where there is a sense of descending to a deep level of ourselves in that interior silence, that deep level of ourselves where we open out into the sea of being in which we live and move and have our being, and we experience a connectedness with what is. Now, there are people throughout religious history and in all of the enduring religions of the world who have had experiences that seemed overwhelmingly to them to be experiences of God, the sacred. In the Bible, for example, the three most central figures, Moses, Jesus, and Paul, are all spoken of as people who experienced God, the sacred, the spirit. The prophets of the Old Testament, responsible for the second major portion of the Jewish Bible, many of them, we are told, had experiences of the sacred. Then there are figures like Abraham, Jacob, Mary, Mary Magdalene, Peter, Thomas, the author of Revelation. All of them are portrayed as people for whom God, the sacred, was an experiential reality. And without belaboring examples, these experiences continue in post-biblical Christianity. Many of the most important figures in the Christian tradition were also, in this broad sense of the word mysticism, mystics. Augustine, Thomas Aquinas, very late in his life, Julian of Norwich, Catherine of Siena, Hildegard of Bingen, Teresa of Avila, John of the Cross, Martin Luther, George Fox, John Wesley, and more. And it isn't just the giants of the tradition who have had such experiences. These experiences have also happened in the lives of unknown, ordinary Christians throughout the centuries. Now, not all Christians have them, and that's okay. There's no pecking order here of a kind of spiritual elite who have these experiences and then a lower class of people who don't. It's not like that. But the notion of meeting God or encountering God is not foreign to many people. And this leads to a very different understanding of the word God, of what the word refers to. Not to a being who can only be believed in. But the word God refers to a radiant presence that fills and pervades the universe. To use William James's most generic term from his classic study, The Varieties of Religious Experience, now over 100 years old, James refers to what is experienced in these experiences as a more. Something more than the visible world of our ordinary experience. Houston Smith, a living Methodist saint to whom I referred in my introduction, refers to a stupendous more. And these experiences lead to what is increasingly commonly called panentheism. Now notice that it's a form of theism, but it's quite different from supernatural theism. Its Greek roots make its meaning clear. The first syllable, pan, means all or everything. The little syllable in the middle, en, is a Greek preposition which means in. And of course, theism comes from theos, the Greek word for God or the sacred. And so the word panentheism means everything is in God. God is not a separate being outside the universe. Rather, the universe and all that is are in the sacred. We are in God like fish are in water. By the way, the creature that probably knows the least about water would be fish. It's the milieu in which they live. They are in the water is in the fish, but they may not even be aware of that until they're pulled out of the water, in which case they might say, "Oh my God!" You know, but anyway. Now, the word panentheism is relatively modern, so far as we know, first used in 1807. Now, there's a piece of trivia for you, okay? Go on Jeopardy. When, let's see, 1807. When was the word panentheism used? I mean, you could win with that one, okay? But the understanding expressed by panentheism is as ancient as the language of supernatural theism. A few biblical examples. One comes from the 139th Psalm, and whether you know your psalms by the numbers or not, it'll be familiar to you as soon as I begin to echo its language. It's probably on most Christians' lists of their five favorite psalms. It's that psalm that includes the question asked by the psalmist, "Whither shall I flee from your presence?" And then the psalmist answers the question by imagining the three-story universe of the ancient imagination. "If I ascend to the highest heaven, behold, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths of the earth in Sheol, behold, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell at the furthermost corners of the sea, behold, you are there." Wherever the psalmist imagines traveling in the universe, God is there. And that's because God is everywhere. Perhaps the most concise expression of this in the Bible is in a verse attributed to Paul in Acts 17:28. Again, it will be familiar to you as soon as I recite it. According to the author of Acts, Paul says, God is the one in whom we live and move and have our being. Notice how the language works. Where are we in relationship to God? We live within God. We move within God. We have our being within God. God is not somewhere else, but right here. Another little aside, a very brief story that I heard only 2 weeks ago, told to me by a grandfather about his 4-year-old grandson. And they're sitting together, I don't know, in a living room, whatever. And the 4-year-old is looking thoughtful and says to his grandfather, "Is God everywhere?" And the grandfather says, "Yes." And the 4-year-old says, "Does that mean God is right here in this room?" And the grandfather says, "Yes." And the 4-year-old says, "Get him out of here." A little bit spooky, you know. But panentheism, of course, means you can't get God out of there. We are in God all the time, whether we know that or not, believe that or not. To do one more thing with the referent of the word God. Many of you know the name Thomas Keating, a contemporary Roman Catholic monk, priest, retired abbot, and teacher of what is called centering prayer. Keating must be almost 90 by now. And it's maybe half a dozen years ago that I heard him give a lecture in which he said that when he seeks to find the most neutral, generic term he can think of for what the word God refers to, his phrase is, "The word God refers to, quote, isness without limits." Now, what on earth is isness without limits? Well, it's this. But without the limits imposed by our categories, our language, our labels, God is isness. Now, does anybody want to get into an argument about whether isness is? You know, somehow I feel like Bill Clinton when I talk like that, you know? Isness manifestly is. And the question of God or the sacred is, what is the nature of isness? Is it simply a swirling mass of matter and energy? And in that sense, nothing extraordinary? Or is isness a radiant, luminous presence in which we live? And this leads to the next point on the outline. If the word God refers to a luminous reality that is all around us, why do we not experience God or the sacred more often? A major biblical diagnosis, namely, our hearts are commonly closed. Biblical synonyms for the closed heart include the shut heart, the hard heart, the stony heart, the fat heart, And by the way, the Greek word for that is sclerocardia. We have sclerosis of the heart, as if there's a hardened layer of scar tissue around ourselves at their deepest level. The word heart in the Bible is a frequent image, symbol, or metaphor for the self at its deepest level, the psyche at its deepest level, a level below our perceiving, our thinking, our feeling, and our deciding, below our intellect, emotions, and will. And the condition of the heart shapes all of them, affects all of them. We do not see very clearly when our hearts are closed. We do not feel the suffering of the world when our hearts are closed. We may know about it, but we don't feel it. A closed heart affects the reasoning process itself and typically leads to self-justification and so forth. Well, why do we have closed hearts? How do they become closed? It happens to all of us through the process of growing up, our socialization, if you will. And growing up, our socialization includes becoming aware of what is sometimes called the self-world distinction. Sounds jargony, but imagine the consciousness of a newborn baby. If it receives decent parenting, it experiences the world as an extension of itself. If it gets hungry, it gets fed. If it gets cold and damp, it gets changed. If it cries, it gets picked up. But no matter how good the parenting, at some point, and I have no idea when, is it 6 months, is it 12 months, 15 months, but I'm convinced it happens in the pre-verbal stage of life, the infant or the toddler becomes aware that the world is something separate from itself and not always responsive to its needs, or at least not immediately responsive to its needs. That's the birth of self-awareness, self-consciousness. The awareness that I'm in here and the world is out there. Again, it happens to all of us. It is, again, it will sound jargony, but I think it's clear what it means. This is the world of the subject-object distinction. I experience myself as subject. I experience the world as object. It's built into our language, into our grammar. I, subject, verb, see, you, object. Now, the inevitable result of the birth of self-awareness, self-consciousness, is self-concern. We learn that the world is not always reliable. We learn that it is something separate from ourselves. And so our hearts, ourselves at their deepest level, become centered in the self. The effect, metaphorically but pretty close to experience, is that we develop a shell around ourselves. It's as if we live within a little dome. I'm in here, you're out there. I sometimes refer to this as the dome of the ego. And as I just said, it happens to all of us, even as the degree of hardness may vary. in extreme form, hardness of heart leads to brutality and violence and so forth. In milder forms, it leads to a sense of separation or estrangement from the world and so forth. Now, given this diagnosis, the remedy, the prescription for cure or healing is for the heart, the self at its deepest level, to be opened. To use a vivid metaphor from the contemporary religious author Frederick Buechner in his novel Godric, the purpose of Christianity, or broaden it, the purpose of religions, or the spiritual life, is for the hatching of the heart. It's a striking metaphor, to say the obvious. It's an egg metaphor, okay? And we all know what happens to the life that is within an egg if the egg does not hatch. It will die, become foul-smelling, sulfuric, putrid. I don't need to go on, do I? But for the life that is within the egg to flourish into full life, the egg must hatch, the shell must break, the heart must open. So I turn to the next part. Experiencing God and the opening of the heart in thin places. Now, thin places is a metaphor or image from Celtic Christianity, which I mentioned at the beginning of the day today. And the metaphor has its home in the affirmation that there are minimally two levels or layers of reality, which is to say it has its home in the notion of panentheism. The world as we ordinarily experience it, on the one hand, and a non-material level or layer that pervades everything that is, and that in a sense is more real than the world of our ordinary experience, more real because according to the religious traditions, the space-time world of matter and energy has its ground in that radiant luminosity that pervades everything. Thin places are occasions when the boundary or border between these two levels of reality becomes very soft, porous, or permeable. To shift the metaphor only slightly, thin places are places or times when the veil lifts and we sense or glimpse or experience the presence of God, the sacred. Now, within Celtic Christianity, thin places can be geographical locations, like traditional destinations of pilgrimage, such as Iona off the west coast of Scotland, which is thought to be a very thin place. Jerusalem, Rome, Canterbury, Mecca, Benares, and so forth. But the notion is a more comprehensive notion than simply geographical places. To broaden the definition, a thin place is an occasion when our hearts are opened, when that shell breaks. A thin place is a mediator of the sacred, and that's the broad meaning of the word sacrament. A sacrament is a mediator of the sacred. And in this broad sense, there are many kinds of thin places, a very brief illustrative list. Nature, for many people, can become a thin place. Perhaps especially experiences of wilderness out there beyond the domestication of culture. For many people, music can become a thin place, whether you are performing it or listening to it. Many women report that childbirth can become a thin place. Sometimes even serious life-threatening illness or deep grief can become a thin place where the heart is virtually broken open, though Lord knows sometimes they're just terrible experiences. And now for a few minutes, I want to speak about thin places and spiritual practices, and for the most part, Christian spiritual practices, and the major purpose of these practices. First of all, a very simple, brief definition of spiritual. Spiritual has to do with our relationship with God. And spirituality is about becoming intentional about a deepening relationship with God. So the purpose of many of our practices in church and as individuals is that they might become the occasion for a thin place. A series of examples with some elaboration now coming at you. A major purpose of worship in its diverse forms is that it might become a thin place. This is the purpose of, on one end of the spectrum, Quaker silence. Perhaps on the other end of the spectrum, Pentecostal enthusiasm. And in between are the more liturgical forms of worship of mainline Protestant churches and the Catholic Church. Purpose of those practices is that they might become the occasion for a thin place. Still within the framework of worship, this is a major purpose of music in the context of worship. Now, this can include performance music as done by the choir, but I'm thinking especially of participatory music that is sung by the congregation. I have seen one study that suggests that the most frequent trigger for the experience of one's heart becoming open in the context of worship is hymn singing that you can sing your hearts out to. By the way, if you take this seriously, it will affect the kind of music chosen for congregational hymn singing. If a hymn is difficult to sing for an untrained musical voice, it has no part in congregational singing. It should have no part. The choir can do the most difficult music it's capable of. And I sometimes get in trouble with music directors about this when I say, if a hymn is difficult for the congregation to sing, it shouldn't be part of the service. And sometimes music directors will say, well, but then we'll lose touch with the tradition of hymnody in the church. And I think to myself, there's probably a reason those hymns are unfamiliar. And we don't preach sermons from the 17th century in order to preserve the preaching tradition of the church. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not talking about contemporary praise music versus traditional Christian hymns. A lot of contemporary praise music is kind of like cheerleading for God, you know, or sappy love songs, you know, I love you, Lord. And there are many traditional hymns that are wonderfully accessible to people without any musical training of the Father's love begotten, late 4th century. O come, Emmanuel, 900s. Be thou my vision, 700s or 800s. I don't need to continue to multiply examples. So the contrast is not between older music and contemporary music, but accessible music. And thus, for the same reason, chant, and perhaps in contemporary American Protestantism, Tese chant is the most familiar. By the way, quick comment about that. Almost every Tese service I've been to in the United States does it wrong. People are somehow given the impression that they're supposed to sing this stuff really softly. And so it's an inhibited form of chant, you know, let's be reverent and do this chant. If you go to Tese in France, the music fills the space. And it's not that people are shouting it out, but people are singing it out, singing their hearts out with this repetitive chant, and it has an effect on the body and the spirit. Building on the example of music, there is also what might be called sacred sound. The scholar who pioneered the research into this was a German scholar named Rudolf Otto, in a book written almost 100 years ago, 1915. The Idea of the Holy. That's a terrible English translation, by the way. It should be called The Experience of the Holy, because the whole book is about the experience of the sacred. And he has an appendix in that book where he reports his study of the sounds that seem to be repeated in all of the religious traditions that he had studied. And the most common repeated sound he describes as the long, protracted, open vowel sound. And he theorizes that this sound has a way of opening up the self, almost in a physiological way. Now, to make that a bit concrete, perhaps the best known long, protracted, open vowel sound is the syllable OM from Eastern religious traditions. OM. But of course, they don't say OM. They do it like this. Become annoying very soon. And the M is simply the closing off of the glottis at the end. And that this sound seems to resonate within the body in a certain way. The most familiar example of this in Western religious traditions, Judaism as well as Christianity, would be Alleluia. And it's no wonder that many of us love hymns with lots of Alleluias in them. Another example of traditional practices that have as their purpose creating a thin place or becoming an occasion for a thin place, sacred time. Not just sacred sound, but sacred times. Perhaps the most vivid example of this is the way the Sabbath is observed within Orthodox Judaism. Without becoming overly detailed, for Orthodox Jews. And by the way, the Sabbath begins at sundown on Friday and lasts until sundown on Saturday. And within Orthodox Judaism, there is an absolute prohibition of working on the Sabbath, with a very detailed elaboration of what constitutes work. Work includes kindling a flame, which means there's no cooking on the Sabbath, no turning on of light switches even. And if you've ever been to Israel on a Sabbath and staying in a hotel, you may have noticed that there's a Sabbath elevator, which is programmed to stop at every floor, because pushing a button to make it stop would be kindling a flame. Now, that may seem like meticulous over-scrupulosity, but it is part of that absolute prohibition of work on the Sabbath. Now, what's that about? It's about this. One day a week, the world returns to the time before work in and on the world began. Another way of putting that, one day a week, the world returns to the time of the Garden of Eden, to paradise. And this explains another feature of the Orthodox Sabbath. Husband and wife are virtually required to make love on the Sabbath. Now, obligatory intercourse may seem grim to you, but the symbolism, again, is perfect. Husband and wife, on that day of the week when the world returns to the Garden of Eden, become the primordial couple in the Garden of Delights, naked and unashamed. This is the use of sacred time as perhaps becoming the occasion for a thin place. We don't have anything that dramatic in the Christian tradition, but think for a moment of our major festivals, Christmas and Easter, and how on those festivals our churches are typically more full than they are any time of the year. And those of us who come regularly sometimes wonder who all these people are and why they aren't here more often, but I don't think they show up just for reasons of convention or nostalgia. It's because there's something about the time of a sacred festival that can have the effect of opening the self up. Moving along more quickly now, Scripture, especially the devotional reading of Scripture, can become a thin place. And by devotional reading, I don't mean, you know, trying to read the Bible from beginning to end and you got to get through a couple chapters today, but that meditative reading of a short passage where you leave silence and space around those words in the hope that perhaps there'll be a word spoken to you in that time. Persons can sometimes become a thin place. My hunch is that Jesus was often a thin place for his followers. So also Saint Francis for his followers. And many of us, I suspect, have met at least one person who became a thin place for us. And then the final example I'll mention, prayer, has as one of its purposes becoming the occasion for a thin place. Prayer in both of its forms, verbal prayer, in which whether out loud or silently with words in our head, we address God, and perhaps especially nonverbal prayer, the prayer of internal silence, contemplative prayer, can become the occasion for a thin place. To move to my conclusion, when hearts are open, what are our lives like when our hearts are open instead of closed, shut, hard? A partial list: an open heart and seeing go together. We see most clearly when our hearts are open. The person who's right there in front of us, street people perhaps, an open heart is alive to wonder, to the sheer wonder of isness. I mean, do you know how remarkable it is that we are here and that we have senses and that there is color and sound? In some ways, the really remarkable thing is that this could ever look ordinary to us. An open heart and gratitude go together. You can almost feel this one in your body. In the moments of deepest gratitude in my life, it almost feels as if my rib cage is cracking open. An open heart and compassion go together. Compassion is both a feeling and a way of acting. Includes not just a feeling, but also deeds of compassion. And you can see why. Compassion is the ability to feel the feelings of another at a level lower than your head. And when our hearts are closed, we possibly can be generous, maybe even kind, but we're not going to feel compassion. And for Jesus, compassion is the central virtue. It's the central quality of God and the central quality of a life that is open to God and centered in God. It's expressed wonderfully in Luke 6:36. If you look it up, by the way, most English translations blow it. They read, "Be merciful as God is merciful," as if, okay, just as God doesn't punish us even though we deserve to be punished, we shouldn't punish other people even though they deserve to be punished. It's a terrible translation, and not all translations get it wrong. But the correct translation would be, as on the handout, "Be compassionate as God is compassionate." Paul says the same thing with the word love. Love is Paul's more abstract word for what Jesus means by compassion. For Paul, love, compassion, is the primary fruit, the primary gift of the Spirit. And finally, in the Bible, an open heart and a passion for justice and the end of violence go together. And that's because justice and peace are the social form of compassion. And I'll say more about that in my afternoon talk. To conclude, the Christian life is about the opening of the heart to the reality and presence of God and our transformation through a deepening relationship with God, a deeper centering in God, and the life of compassion that flows from that. Thank you.